We now have two short comments to kick off discussion, and we'll start with Ruth Lister.
Could I have a bit more light here? yeah, indeed. Well, as always, John was both stimulating and entertaining. And I want to go back to his starting question, which was, when we encounter public services, who do we think we are? Because I think it's a critical question. And I think it's worth reflecting further on it to draw out the implications of John's analysis for citizenship. Does it matter if we think we are consumers or citizens when we engage with public services? I would say yes, it does. That's not to say the identity of consumer and citizen are incompatible. I mean, indeed, I think one of the interesting developments recently has been how consumers are using their power as consumers to, say, boycott certain goods or to buy fair trade goods to act as global citizens. But John's analysis and that of others suggests that the government is encouraging us to see ourselves first and foremost as consumers exercising choice when we engage with public services. Some evidence to suggest that actually it's not what people most want and that choice can be more burdensome than empowering. One of the most telling statements I think that has come out of the present government very early on in its first annual report was by the Prime Minister in his introduction to the report, when he says, in all walks of life, people act as consumers, not just citizens. The implication being that being a consumer is a higher calling than being a citizen. And then he went on, they want those providing a service to justify themselves. How much is it costing me? Cost. It immediately conjures up the figure of the taxpayer. In his written version of the paper, John talks about the splitting of the citizen into the different identities of taxpayer, consumer, and scrounger. We don't talk so much about scroungers these days. It's a more subtle language of passive welfare dependent. But in any case, it's rather these identities rather than those of equal citizens with dignity who deserve respect. I think the consumer relationship is primarily an individualized relationship. It's when we think, you know, what is best for ourselves, what is best for our families, and tough if that's at the expense of others. And there's a very interesting little footnote in John's paper, and obviously he didn't have time to give the footnotes, but when he talks about an example in Yorkshire Water, when we had the drought and people being encouraged to conserve water, and they turned around and said, well, why should we? You privatise water, we're now consumers. It's up to you to sort it out, not us. It's not a citizenship relationship. We don't care, you know, you've told us not to care. And if something goes wrong, it's about individual redress rather than trying to improve the service through collective action. A citizenship relationship, and I'm not trying to say this was some golden past, because it clearly it wasn't. This is perhaps some sort of alternative future, picking up John's end point. Yes, a citizenship relationship is partly about individual rights, but it's also about being a citizen is also about being about membership of a wider community and responsibility to that wider community. And I'm not talking about responsibility perhaps in the kind of the conditional sense of, you know, with rights come responsibilities, but a wider sense that we, you know, we care about each other and about the services that we're all receiving, and a concern for the public realm, David Markram's been making recently. Arguably, the promotion of the consumer stroke taxpayer over the citizen is doing more to undermine the solidarity that underpins the welfare state than the ethnic differences. It's so fashionable to argue these days is what is undermining that collective solidarity. Now, of course, citizenship, I'm not arguing that citizenship is not part of the present government's lexicon. It actually has a very privileged position in it. But I think it's a notion of citizenship which effectively depoliticizes it and which treats it as primarily instrumental to economic success and social cohesion. And then finally, I think I'm still within my 3 to 5 minutes, I just really want to, perhaps in an act of solidarity with John, underline his point about structural inequalities, come out as old-fashioned, if that's what it is. Although, interestingly, I think more and more commentators are acknowledging that we can't talk about these issues, we can't talk about social exclusion without talking about these underlying structural inequalities. Indeed, the Social Exclusion Unit itself, in its latest report, is the inequality word is back on the agenda, and I've heard Yvette Cooper using, and has written the I word. We don't have the R word yet of redistribution, but we do have the I word of inequality. An acknowledgement that social exclusion is not something that stands separate from some of these inequalities. Unfortunately, when questioned about this at a recent Social Exclusion Unit conference, she did then fall back onto the safe ground of equality of opportunity rather than inequalities of income and resources. But I think there is an opening there, a chink that can be used. And then just the one other point I just wanted to pick up from what John said, which links in with inequality, is about inequalities of voice and the point he made about different forms of expertise and the expertise born of experience. And this is something that increasingly is part of the politics of poverty, that people in poverty want their expertise of what it means to be poor to be heard, and that there, when we talk about voice and choice, we have to make sure that it's the voices and choices of all our citizens that are heard and that count.
Ed.
Well, thank you. And again, John, that was a kind of great lecture. I had the benefit of getting a kind of 30-page kind of pre-version. I don't know which was sort of, you know, more quite scary to kind of work through it. But it was a kind of, it was a great speech. It was sort of delivered with humour and style. And I think you raised, you know, a lot of kind of genuine issues. I think you probably put more questions than necessarily you gave answers. But I think that that is a very legitimate function, if you like, for academics. There's bits I don't quite kind of go from. And to some extent, the kind of the words we use can be a bit like bits of Lego, and we put these bits of words together and it kind of makes sense maybe in kind of academic or political discourse, particularly when some words are quite highly charged around it. But quite what it means, I'm not sure, because I mean, my concern is around the way that people experience public services and the way that people are treated by public services. So I kind of start with some of the, you started with a kind of a whole set of things that what you thought you saw as unsettling the public realm. I guess with an indication that these were in some ways sort of problematic, and I just want to kind of stand up for three of them that you mentioned. I think if these unsettle the public realm, well then get on and unsettle it. The first is the refusal of the subordinated. So people with disabilities refusing to be cast out, refusing not to be allowed into kind of, you know, buildings because of it. I think that's a good thing. The decline of deference, you know, the treatment of cancer patients. Professor of Cancer Care, kind of read something recently, just looking at the way that it's sort of inhumanity is enshrined in some hospital systems. It's just in the myriad incidents of carelessness and the way that people are treated. If that's going to be tackled with a decline of deference, you know, roll on. And the politics of difference, you know, addressing racism and institutional racism within police and other forces, you know, I think kind of go for it. So they may be unsettling the public realm, but I think kind of somehow those are quite progressive forces. You then go through the kind of the mechanisms in which people that are using public services can influence or shape those public services. And I kind of think you want to set them up and then kind of knock them down. And so just let me kind of again speak up for those. First is around, you know, choice and choices. You know, we don't have that many choices, and it varies across different public services. Some public services like, you know, regulation, you know, or taxation, we probably have very little choices. Others particularly where they're consumed individually, you know, housing or the like, you know, we perhaps have more, but we don't have many. You know, my critique of public services, and, you know, if you look at a lot of the kind of commissions on poverty that have been done over years, and Ruth would probably bear this out, you know, there's both issues around structural inequalities and kind of pay and income, and then there's the issue of stigma. And that's something that comes out of the kind of research that we've been doing at the National Consumer Council, just looking at, you know, poverty, both in the marketplace and elsewhere, is the issue of stigma and the way that if people are treated as having stigmatized and not having choices. It's examples. Children in care, when asked about the kinds of choices that they would want, I want to be able to join the football team down the road. I want to be able to see my mother's grave. These are simple things that if you deny, you lose a huge amount. So I think choice has got a place, and I think it is can be a participatory process, although I completely accept many of the kind of limitations that you say are there around choice and particular resources. And then voice. There's as many self-help groups now in health per 1,000 adults as there are GPs, and that means that there's an entirely different kind of approach to health that is going on. It's not simply about the NHS, it is about ourselves as patients taking care of our own diseases and organising around that. And again, I see that as, you know, not entirely problematic, but in general, kind of a, you know, a positive thing. Now, the tensions that you come on to, kind of rationing is there. I think rationing is a big issue. It's not talked about. And I think you're quite right to put that kind of full square as an issue here. And with the NHS, it's never been clear what's in and what's out of the NHS. And we don't really know where our kind of rights as citizens or our responsibilities as consumers or however language we use start and stop. And there are many ways in which you can use that money. At the same time, it seems to me that that kind of rationing decision cannot be taken back, you know, as a kind of central planning model behind closed doors. This has to be done in an open and a transparent and a participatory way. And the idea that the only choices that we should have as users of public services is the kind of vote every 5 years for one political party or another is just laughable. We need other forms of input than that. And I think the question is, so I accept the point about rationing, I accept entirely the point that public services are, you know, different substantially to market operations and to saying one and the other should be the same doesn't stack up. While at the same time wanting to kind of challenge the notion that consumers are this, you know, are this sort of neoliberal view of a kind of one-dimensional, isolated, rational, self-interested person. It's just not the way that consumers operate. It's not the way that people kind of operate in the marketplace as well as certainly public services. And I'd like to kind of speak up for the kind of the role which I think you underplay and I think you devalue of the growing kind of user movement around public services. And that's the long history of tenant movement and struggles against forms of professionalism in housing. It's children getting involved in aspects of school life, school councils or the like, and it's people with patients with chronic conditions, you know, taking care of their own conditions and managing their own health. I think you discount their role, and we're looking forward at those kinds of tensions and what may be a kind of a genuine and fair critique of some of the limits of public services, particularly in relation to inequality. I would say don't underestimate the power and the potential of the user movement in public service life and public service improvement. After all, you know, who stands up for public services? That's got to be the ultimate test. You know, we're seeing cuts in legal aid. We're seeing the emergence of kind of advice deserts, you know, where people can't get hold of kind of, you know, legal aid or often other forms of advice. Who stands up for those? When those cuts are, you know, go through, when the gravy train, to quote the kind of Prime Minister of kind of legal aid, is challenged, who stands up for it? And the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have gone through the legal aid system but have not felt empowered to stand up for that, that those professionals have used them but not equipped and empowered them to stand up for it. I think only when you get not just I think public ownership, because I think people are not so concerned whether something's delivered by the public sector or the private sector or the like. They care about the values, but they care more about the quality of service. It's not public ownership we should be looking at. It's a public sense of ownership. And the question again is, how do you really build that? That ultimately will be rebuilt public services as a force for tackling inequality. So thank you, John, and the tensions and issues, I think, don't go away.
Thank you, Ed. John will have a time to come back to these questions, but I want to open it up because most of us here either have been users of public service, will be users of public service, or if you're very lucky, you're just paying for our public services. So I'm sure there are lots of views on this question, whether we want more choice, less choice, different kinds of choice, and what we should really want to preserve sense of public. So I want to throw the floor really open, and you can ask the entire panel or direct your questions to a particular person. We have two roaming mics on either side, so if you have a question, just raise your arm, but I would like you to briefly say who you are when you have a question. So let's take a first couple of questions here in the front. Bob Worcester and you. Yes.
Thanks, Bob Worcester. And I have so many hats that were represented by the speakers, Advisory Board of the National Consumer Council, and involved in ESRC, and of course as chairman of MORI. I was very, very taken by Ruth Lister's going back to the question that Frank started with. Who do we think we are? But that wasn't the question. The question was, who are we? And I think probably more important than who we think we are is who they think we are. I see I've got Frank on board already, because they see us and they put us down. Ed, I couldn't agree with you more, the refusal of subordinated, the end or the challenging of politics of deference and difference. And we did, at MORI, we did the work, 10 years ago, I suppose, with the British public on something that nobody mentioned, and boy was I listening for it, the Citizens' Charter. Because you concluded, Frank, with what are the levers of power that citizens have. And what we found in that research was the people who valued the Citizens' Charter were the uneducated, the poor, the disadvantaged. Because they told us in focus groups and in quantitative surveys, well, I didn't know what I could say to a policeman. I didn't know what I could say to a doctor. I didn't know I could ask about what he was or she was telling me. And that's empowerment. And I had the opportunity last summer at a conference to say to John Major, did you ever know about that work we did for the Charter Unit in the Cabinet Office about a Citizens' Charter? And he said, no, they never told me about it. And I'm so glad that you did, because, I mean, he used more words, but that was my big idea, was what he said. He said, when I was growing up, I didn't know what my rights were either. And I wanted to give people who needed to know and tell them what their rights were.
Thank you, Bob. And there was a question here on the aisle.
David Laverick, the Pensions Ombudsman. I wanted to pick up on something that Ruth said as well about the myth that choice is, in 1066 terms, a good thing. And I know that there has been some recent research about the multiplicity of choice being itself a problem. But it seems to me that at a much more basic level, the question of choice, even if you're faced with just a choice of two, isn't necessarily what the citizen as consumer is looking for. A year ago, I was hobbling around on a stick, and for a brief few moments before that, I was lying in a field about a mile and a half from my home and wondering how I was going to get to a hospital or indeed anywhere else with a leg that wasn't supporting me at all. It didn't occur to me to wonder which hospital I wished to be taken to. And indeed, whilst we were at a bit of a pinch, I could have said, well, no, don't go to the one down the road, go 25 miles away to Leeds. had I been living a further 10 miles away, I think even that wouldn't really have been a choice at all. And for very many people in rural areas, there is no choice of school as to where to go. There is no choice of hospital. But what they want isn't in fact a choice. What they want is assurance that they will get an acceptable level of treatment or of education at the place nearest to them. Linked to that, I wondered whether any of your panel has got any thoughts upon the choice that I'm afraid I make, and very many of the electorate in York where I live make, of not taking the opportunity to being empowered that my city council offers me. York pioneered a system some years ago of having local neighbourhood forums which are invited to take decisions as to how to ration the resources which are available, limited resources available for discretionary spending. I'm afraid I have not been one of the half dozen or so people in my ward who choose to go along once a quarter to influence the way that's done. And as I say, the vast majority of people choose not to take that opportunity of being empowered. On a different scale, the vast majority of people choose not to take the opportunity of electing their councillors, and indeed increasingly not taking the opportunity of electing their MPs either.
Thank you. Let's take these two questions. John, why don't you start?
I can't believe that I'm going to get another chance so quickly. It seems unreasonable. I want to tell Bob Worcester a little story, because when we were constructing the research design for the project, we started out with what I think of as being the two basic questions. And one question was, who do we think we are when we encounter public services? And the other one was yours, which is, who do they think we are when we encounter? And it does seem to me that there is a dynamic across that, which is terribly important, and part of the confusion that surrounds citizen-consumer questions is about where anybody places themselves in that. And I understand the pressure and the dynamic to make public services more responsive, respectful, and so on. And my question is whether the mode of doing it is the one that will deliver the changes that I think we deserve. So I can't think about Citizens Charters without thinking about the Cums hotline. And somebody said that in the thing I was in earlier today. And that, I think, confused all of us about the Citizens Charters. Anyway, quick thought about choice. And I think that the choice thing is peculiar, because I do think that in most circumstances, in positions where we have needs, we want to be... we want to get the things put right. And we want an assurance of standards. We want an assurance of being treated decently. And I mean, if it wasn't such a funny word, I mean, respect floats in and out of these conversations in a complicated way, I think. We want to be treated respectfully. We do not want to have to defer. We would rather prefer it if, not that people deferred to us, but actually just managed to get round to treating us as if we were part of the same group, species. And what I remember from earlier NCC reports is an argument which said people go for choice when they can't get standards. Right? So choice becomes a loop rather than a primary virtue. Choice is what you go for, what you pursue, if you can't get what you're looking for the first time round. Right? It's a sort of fallback position. And so the question is, what is it that assures first position, rather than requiring us to do complicated things? And I was at a Catalyst seminar 2 weeks ago, at which somebody told the obverse of your story, which is, she was in a major road accident, and an ambulance came out to the motorway in which rescue took her out of a mangled car and said, your legs look in a terrible state. Which hospital would you like to go to? She said, I don't know. I haven't read the witch report on the local hospitals.
I don't know. Take me to a hospital that will look after me.
First criterion. And she got to the hospital and she met a specialist. And I don't know what to do. I mean, this is an awful story. Who said, you're going to have to choose. Do you want functioning or non-functioning legs? What? I mean, you know, in what mode are you supposed to make that choice? And that's the relationship between power and expertise and choice that I think strangles us. She said, I don't even know what the difference between functioning and non-functioning legs are. I can't see mine. Would you like to tell me about them? I have visions of you lying in this field and somebody, a little helicopter dropping in and saying, look, we could fly you to anywhere in the country. You know, to overcome the postcode lottery, we could fly you to anywhere you'd like to go. Where would you most like to go with your broken leg? And you could pick somewhere with a nice view, you know, a pleasant outlook. You know, you've got friends and relatives nearby. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. It seems a funny commitment of resources to take you to a nice place rather than one that would mend your leg.
Ed and Bruce, do you want to come in there?
Okay. Just briefly on the Citizens Charter, I hadn't heard of that research either, I have to admit. And I think it's interesting because there's an assumption, I think, in political discourse these days that people know their rights and they don't know their responsibilities. And certainly research that I, with colleagues, carried out for the ESRC, just to give the ESRC another plug, with young people, found the absolute opposite, that young people were found it much harder to articulate their rights than they did their responsibilities. They knew about their responsibilities to be, you know, paid work, good in the community and so forth. They could reel it off. But so I suspect... that I think people still are not at all aware of what their rights are, and particularly more disadvantaged people. The question about the choice not to take the opportunity to be empowered, I think it's an important question. I mean, again, thinking from the perspective of more disadvantaged groups, I think there's a real danger of creating a new obligation, you know, to be empowered, to be involved, to go to meetings and so forth. People, as we all know, have very busy lives. Time is at a premium, not just for kind of executive-type people, but you know, women with children, whatever. Meetings tend to be held at not the most convenient times. The expectation is that you will go to the meeting, they won't come to you, or if they do, it through sort of questionnaires that are kind of people just throw in the bin because they're pretty incomprehensible. So, yes, I think many people don't take up the opportunity, partly because they lead such overburdened lives, partly because I think they don't think it will make a difference. I mean, I think that's why many people don't vote these days, because they don't think it will make a difference. I think if people think it will make a difference, they're much more likely to take up the opportunities that are available to them. So, for instance, I think turnout has been higher on New Deal for Communities boards in many areas and they have for local government elections because people have felt actually might actually make a difference in their local community as to who is on those boards. Also, I think, again, from the perspective of people in poverty, I was involved in a commission that was looking at the barriers to enabling people in poverty to be involved in decision making that affects their lives in public services or whatever. And one of the strongest messages that came over to us was that people felt that they were not treated with respect, and that was absolutely crucial, and it picks up your point about stigma, Ed. And that actually one of the most disrespectful things was what they called phony consultation. You know, people who would come along, pretend to consult, and then never tell you what the outcome was. There was a wonderful, I'm sorry for going on a bit, but there was just a wonderful example of where there was a sort of public meeting, the local councillors and officials were, you know, asked to come along, they spoke, it was all about consultation. The minute they spoke, they went off to a meeting they said, we've got to go off to another meeting about democracy or something, so they didn't even wait to hear what people had to say, you know, just classic.
I think the examples of that you just described are examples of kind of appalling patient focus. It's just, you know, it's like, and you say it in your paper, you know, John, when the kind of the trains stopped calling us passengers and started calling us customers, you know, and sort of, you know, the old hospital has probably done the same. And it's, you know, it's a symptom of a system that has actually been completely disconnected from appropriate ways to really, you know, deal with the little bits that add up to kind of respect and patient care. And then kind of stumbling into, you know, what seems to be, oh, there's a different model that will deliver it. And yet the point is not to stop making that effort. The point is to do it right. And it seems to me that emergency services probably isn't the place to start with choice. And I think the two examples are you know, great for that. And the point that you say about people want an acceptable service must be right. That must be the kind of first concern. Sometimes that put across as people want the best service locally, which is not going to happen because there are variations in service. So you can't always get the best service locally, but an acceptable service seems to be absolutely right. Once you've got that, then I think you can talk about choice. In research by Picker Institute, looking at people's relationship with GPs, kind of one out of five people really want the doctor to make the decisions. Cut the legs off. Just tell me, you know, that not what a GP would do. But actually, most of the others want to share that decision making in one way or another. Some extreme may want to make that decision themselves, but others want a kind of a flow of information that can make that a shared decision. And that probably is the case for an increasing number of people. So my sense is, put, as you said, acceptable level of services first. Once you've got that, then I still think there's an overriding need to improve the way that people experience these services and to do it in ways that is more closely attuned to really where people are starting from.
Thank you. Let's take a few more questions. Let's start with the side. There are three questions here, beginning fifth row. Yes, can we help?
Matthew Warburton from the Local Government Association. I wanted to reflect that Ed made the point, and Bob Worcester echoed it, that absolutely right to support the decline of deference, what John called the refusal of the subordinated, and so on. I didn't hear John say that was anything wrong. I think the question that I want to ask is, why did we end up in a situation where it was perceived that the way to express the demand of people to be treated, fairly, properly, by public services, was not in the language of citizenship, that I am a citizen, I deserve to be treated as a citizen, but in the language borrowed by, you know, I deserve to be treated in the same way as I am treated in McDonald's. Why haven't I got the same rights and expectations?
Can I ask, I mean, who actually says that? Does anybody actually say that?
Well, actually, if you put together what Tony Blair said about the health service and what Margaret Thatcher said about the health service, yes. I mean, the language is, the metaphor is that in the market, consumers are treated, consumers have expectations. We need to reproduce those expectations, deliver the same kind of thing in the public sector. I think that has been said on a number of occasions, and it's how I understand the thing. But the question is, why? Why? How do we end up in a situation where that way of expressing the issue was considered more plausible and more saleable than one which was expressed in the language of citizenship? And has it got something to do with the difficulty, actually, of articulating, I mean, our inability to really come to terms? Somebody said that the I word had been used earlier on. There is this tension between equity and inequality of treatment. We're not always sure exactly what we do mean by fair treatment. And in a sense, you know, moving to the language of consumption and choice is, in a sense, a cop-out from addressing that hard question. That's one theory, one suggestion, but I'd be interested in other views.
Yeah, hi. I just want to make the point, sorry. My observation of public servants is that they have a bit of amnesia. While they're under contract as public servants, they seem to forget that they are consumers and citizens. For example, John's example of the doctor with the non-functioning or functioning legs, maybe if he thought what it might be like to be sitting in that consulting room as the patient. And my observation in mental health is exactly the same, that patients are treated as others, as different, and if the professionals actually imagine what it would like to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act, the service would be very different. And I accept the points about rationing and structural inequality, but I think that would make a massive difference if professionals themselves could imagine for even 5 minutes what it's like to be sitting in that chair opposite to the professional. Thanks.
Steph, there was, we skipped one person, Tim.
Oh, sorry.
No, two rows, who's been very patient there.
Thanks. Hello, Terry Newholm, Open University. John, I know that you've obviously had framed all of what you said in terms of public services, but I was just kind of exploring the idea of whether what you were saying was so unique to public services. I know some of it is, but some of it I could sort of move to the market and be saying similar things, like the market is increasingly being questioned in terms of its relationship to inequalities. It's been questioned in terms of its relationship to choice. So Tim Lang, for instance, would challenge the idea of market and choice. And in also in terms of deference. So, you know, we could say we had sort of deference to the leaders of industry, that they, as it were, knew best as to what to do in those things. And I think increasingly that's being challenged, you know, in terms of what they're paid and the decisions that they make. So, you know, I'm thinking that we have these tensions, but are they, if they're not unique really to the public services, then the rest of our structures are also subject to them.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a point about the attenuation of choice, because I think when choice was used, choice has been an important term in the women's healthcare movement. And I think when it's been used then, it meant something quite different than the choice to have your cataracts removed by Bupa or by the NHS. I think it was a more collective vision of choice, where you could be seen as influencing the production of public services kind of upstream, if you like. And I wonder if, is it possible to construct a radicalised vision of choice which doesn't just kind of flow along with the critique of deference that runs with big business interests, that kind of criticises professionals, but also, it, say in health terms, criticises big pharma and goes along with some user groups which have called for influence over healthcare research, which drives the direction of the healthcare system and asks for more funding for environmental research and so on. You know, could we get a more radicalised idea of choice there?
Very interesting questions. Let's give John a chance first.
I have this sense of anachronism. Okay, here I am in a New Labour world, and the questions that are being posed are not those which dominate the political agenda. And one of the strange things about this particular phase of modernity, wanted to say that for ages, is the discrepancy between small private and small public conversations on the one hand, and national and transnational political discourses on the other. And one of the things that I want to say about all the questions is that they pose things in ways that I never hear in public political discourse. They put challenges about how we live, how we think, and who we are into different forms than those which circulate in the sort of big space. One of the things that I puzzled about a lot is how on earth we get those small publics, those small voices, articulated into the big public spaces. So I suggest that we all sign up for a mass political movement this evening, which is called Restoring the New Left and Friends, or some such, and you know, we could... right, okay, that's not going to work. I think, though, that what they point to is a question about language in the different realms. And I do think that it is interesting that we have ended up, by and large, imagining choice as something that individual consumers exercise through the cash nexus. I don't think that... And one of the things that I struggle with, then, is that's not what people I know making choices do in everyday life, except in the cash nexus. And I do not believe the Tony Blair quote that actually our life is taken up by going out shopping. I mean, may be true for a few people, but it seems to me that people have rather more complicated and difficult lives than that, and that what they take part in is what Ed said about forms of shared decision making. Everyday life, in workplaces sometimes, in households sometimes, in our negotiations with our friends, near friends, sometimes enemies, we do difficult and complicated shared decision making. We do negotiating. And it seems to me that there's something going on around shared decision making at different sorts of levels that needs to be made visible. And to get us out of the sort of stick point of the market tells us how it works, because I agree with Terry that I think there are all sorts of challenges emerging unevenly, difficultly, to whether that is an adequate, proper, productive, useful, civilised way of life. And that bounces in and out, and it never quite disrupts it, except on an anti-globalisation grand scale and at some local scale. So I think there's lots of things there that really are about, and I am going to reclaim, of course, the phrase refusals of the subordinated, because I agree with you about those being progressive forces. I still am delighted that the public realm was unsettled, because that form of a public realm that accommodated to that form of society was not satisfactory. And so, unsettling is good. I don't want to go for the current attempt to resettle it in this form. I want a bit more unsettling, a bit more progress, and something to look forward to in my declining years.
And I sometimes think discussions about public services and public service reform is a bit like sort of waiting for the number 10 bus in the rain. It never really comes. So it's sort of waiting for Godot or common agricultural policy reform. And so it sort of seems as if it's this kind of endless, you know, process. And actually we've been kind of unremittingly negative this evening. And so I guess it just occurs to me to note that it is not all unremittingly negative. And, you know, there have been things, there have been no magic keys, no magic bullets in terms of public service improvement, but there have been, you know, kind of learnings and some steps forward. I think Sure Start, you know, is a fantastic example of a kind of new public service, you know, focused on areas that do address inequalities, because inequalities start very, very young, and is designed in a way that is actually kind of very responsive to the different, you know, users and encourages their kind of participation. Primary schools, customer satisfaction, user satisfaction, call it what you like, with primary schools, you know, is very, very high now. That's actually amongst parents, not quite so high amongst children, but it is still pretty high. So there are, you know, examples of stuff that is, you know, positive and good. The National Consumer Council, we were founded in the 1970s by Michael Young, and we were founded with a remit, not just for dealing with the wide consumer interest, but also particularly for dealing with issues of disadvantage in the market, but also for dealing with public service and public service users. So we've had to kind of straddle this kind of combined area, you know, for a long time, and we found that it has to be something of a dance, but you can do it. We're doing it in new fields like sort of sustainable consumption, you know, which again is an area of consumer responsibility. More than as much as sort of consumer rights. So kind of my money, and you know, kind of anybody here, you know, from the user movement, you know, my money is on the user movement. My money is actually on building the capacity of people to engage with public services through whatever mechanism that gets through your Gordian knot, and whether that's voice, certainly, choice, yes, certainly. But I like the idea of deciding what kind of choice, you know, we do want, and thinking in a more radical way that this is about choice, not simply about choice, but it's about whose choice. This is about whose choice and distribution. It's about informed choice, and also it's about sustainable choice. I think that is a recipe for public service reform that John could have set us on the path this evening.
Question you asked about why, in a sense, why the metaphor of the market rather than the language of citizenship. I think it's partly because the market is seen as superior. You know, it's interesting the point that was then made that some of the same criticisms are being made of the market. I think it's also because we don't actually have a very strong tradition of citizenship in this country. I suspect that this kind of metaphor wouldn't go down so well in France, say, where people actually think of themselves as citizens in a way that we've not really been encouraged to in this country. So it's perhaps easier to slip into that, even, you know, despite T.H. Marshall and so forth. I think the point that was made about professionals putting themselves into the shoes of the person opposite them, I think it's a very good one. And I think it's one that, I mean, it's, I think you use the example in terms of the health service myself at a very distressing time. I was appalled at the way, you know, I was treated. And I was, you know, an articulate, middle-class, white person. And we think, how would it be for someone who was not articulate, not white, not middle class? And that was in a situation where any professional should have been able to think what it was like being in that position. Finally, can we have a more radical form of choice? An example of the women's health movement. I'm not sure I'd use the word choice here, and I think it goes back to some of the things John was talking about in terms of, you know, user movements, social movements, saying, you know, we have different needs, and we want services to acknowledge those, you know, the needs of women, the needs of particular ethnic groups and so forth. Whether choice is the right way to express that, I'm not sure. But I think, I mean, the women's health movement was incredibly important in that, you know, those needs are now much better recognised than they were. But I'm not sure it was a language of choice that was necessarily used. It's more about awareness of the different kinds of needs that people have. But on the basis of differences rather than diversity, the distinction that John was making.
There will be time to continue this discussion in a more informal setting in the reception, which is right next door. I want to give John a chance to have a last word.
It's more than one word, though, isn't it? It's got to be lots of words. I want to say three things. That movements are the stuff of life. Whether it's the women's health movement, whether it's user movements, whether it's the struggle against forms of inequality, the struggle over difference, they are political, cultural, social forces that constantly rework, transform the landscape and make governing difficult. So I want to make a gesture, and it's a very small gesture to something that Ed said, which is that, yes, some good things have happened. Go on then, you just about persuaded me, yes, some good things have happened. And I think that's because governing is difficult. And that's because movements, people ganging together, make governing difficult. They put demands and pressures on governments. And if nothing else, please, please let us go on being difficult. Because difficult is the route to other futures, other possibilities. We do not have to live this way. Let's be difficult. Over a drink.
Before... I see there might be more room for another party led by John Clark than I was aware of before this evening. But before we start on that project and have a drink, let me remind you, if you think this question is difficult and interesting, that we have a next public event which will move this to an even more global level. And we're very much looking forward to hear one of the leading European experts, Gerhard Schoerhorn of the Wuppertal Institute for Climate, Environment and Energy, who on the 21st of May in this venue will unfold for us a new model of sustainable consumer society. And I hope you'll be able to join us for that. But I want to thank again John Clark for thought-provoking talk, and to Ruth Lister and at Mayo for getting us sorted out the political future, and to you for a very interesting discussion. Thank you.